Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 10th of June. This year, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association will host their 19th annual energy fair, June 20th through June 22nd in Custer, Wisconsin. And I have a feeling they will have many more than the 20,000 fair attendees who come each year simply because of what's happened with the cost of gasoline, with the transfer to gas to vehicles that are less gas-guzzling than SUVs, with people really being hit by the high price of fuel. Each summer, the Energy Fair has a number of people who look at a number of issues, and we are very happy to have with us two of the presenters at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair today to talk about the high price of gasoline, to talk about how quickly we can move to alternatives and what's in process, what you can do now to cut the cost of gasoline, what about mass transit in the state of Wisconsin. We have two guests with us from the Institute for Sustainable Energy Education, which is a grassroots energy think tank and outreach organization that's made up of concerned scientists, concerned citizens who focus on providing awareness and education as it relates to the science and economics of energy. Their mission is to use hard science and quantifiable data to improve the quality of our vision for a more sustainable energy future. Our guests are John Richter, co-founder of the Institute for Sustainable Energy Education, former president of the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association. He has presented to the U.S. congressional staff on wind energy policy issues and also on renewable energy policy recommendations to Michigan legislators and staffs. He has created curriculum materials for K through 12 renewable energy education and has earned a BS in engineering with a minor in economics from Oakland University. He is pursuing a Master of Science right now in renewable energy. John, good morning and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen, and I'm very glad to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you here today. Tim Hudson is also with us, co-founder of the Institute for Sustainable Energy Education, a regular speaker at regional energy conferences. He's also a business entrepreneur and has founded and operated several Michigan-based technology companies, and he has worked on several high-technology startups involved in other related activities. He has a bachelor's in computer science at Oakland University. Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You know, you read the news reports, and let's just start with the high cost of gasoline now, particularly in the South, where people make, you know, the average of $11,000 a year. I would imagine that there are significant problems in rural Wisconsin where there isn't very much mass transit. How in the world are people coping? What are the stories that you're hearing about how this enormously high price of gas is affecting all of us?
Well, I think right now, mostly what people are doing are cutting back spending in other areas so they can simply afford the gasoline, because that's just the first thing that they can do. And then certainly I hear a lot of people shopping for new cars that are more efficient, a lot of questions on hybrids and how that can reduce their fuel consumption. And then I'm just beginning to hear people talk about moving closer to work.
Really?
And Kathleen, one of the things we noticed that as these prices started escalating, since we have been talking about this topic when oil was at $10 a barrel back in 97, that basically the whole idea is some kind of new miracle technology-oriented supply source is going to come in and bring those prices down if we can only find out who the culprit is that's preventing that. And what people are beginning to realize is perhaps, you know, it's not the government, it's not the evil corporations, it's not even these evil oil countries, it is a geological limit, and perhaps now they are considering where they live. Why am I living in the suburbs? Why am I not back in the city? Mm-hmm. And that's a big shift from what we were hearing back in 97.
Mm-hmm. You also read these reports, which are discouraging. You've seen them in the last few days, of the number of people, huge increase in the number of people riding mass transit, but cities can't afford to expand mass transit because they're facing problems as well. So the buses are crowded, the L's are crowded, everything's too crowded, and they can't expand.
Yeah, and we're really seeing that sort of problem, not just with mass transit, but also in the energy industry. The cost of building power plants has gone up 170%. The cost of drilling for oil has gone up 200-300%. And just everything that is going to address this problem, those industries are all pushed at their kind of technical limits, and we're certainly seeing that in mass transit, which is not all that easy to expand.
Right.
And Kathleen, one little comment.
Sure.
We were with a gentleman that founded or runs the an organization in Yellow Springs, Ohio, called the Community Solutions. His name's Pat Murphy. And at last week's conference, which was, by the way, the first conference in Michigan for peak oil and climate change in Grand Rapids, done by a local school teacher, Aaron Weisner, he presented a concept that says, let's not look at initially mass transit during the immediate first couple years of when these prices hit, but let's look at putting more people in the cars we're driving anyways. And he literally launched a concept called the Jitney, where everybody is almost like a taxi driver, and they manage that through the web internet 2.0 technology, so that if I'm driving somewhere, I may pick up a few neighbors on the way, and we manage it all via the internet. And that, so there may be some solutions that help us get to the kind of building of the mass transits or the rails that John mentioned.
Right. And the alternative fuels. You know, shame on us. We've known that this is going to happen for years. We've been through this before. And we haven't advanced, I don't think, as rapidly as we should in getting together some alternative fuels. What's the delay?
Well, it's a tough nut to crack. So you remember in the 70s, we had the Carter administration's synthetic fuels program. And they demonstrated we clearly can make oil out of coal. And it's just fantastically expensive to do so. So once oil prices dropped back down, those plans were all shelved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the Bush administration is focused on ethanol as a future, and we're now converting 20% of our corn crop into ethanol to run our cars. But clearly, that's not the solution. And we're holding out cellulosic ethanol as perhaps, you know, that is the synthetic fuel of the near future. But that's still in the pilot plant stage, despite Congress's mandates that it be commercialized.
Right.
And Kathleen, one of the things when we talk about fuel, you know, John really taught me about this whole energy situation when way back in our teenage years. And I constantly thought, okay, there's going to be some other type of fuel. Let's go to the renewables, right? We've got the solar and the wind, and clearly there's a lot of wind and a lot of sun. But that really doesn't solve the fact that we have an infrastructure built on liquid fuels, particularly a very dense one that we call gasoline oil. And so, in a way, the biggest problem is really re-electrifying transportation so that we can actually get off of the liquid fuels, which are all pretty much fossil fuel-based, or they have some of these problems John mentioned. So we got this big issue of people first just coming to grips with, you mean we're going to do electrification of America's transportation system like we did when we kind of electrified the grid for our culture way back in time. So I think that's something people haven't really adapted to, what it takes to kind of re-electrify the driving.
Right. I was wondering what's going to happen to ethanol this year, too, as you're looking at cornfields in Iowa just being flooded. I mean, the state is flooded as Wisconsin is flooded. That's going to have some kind of impact this year, don't you think?
I would certainly think so.
Yeah. What do you hear about what people are doing? You talk about they're moving closer. I'm thinking about rural areas in the state of Wisconsin and Michigan and all over the Midwest and all over the South. You hear stories of people who are running out of gas and just leaving their cars on the side of the road. Some companies who are fearful of losing employees, and so they're paying people a special price for gasoline so that they can get to work. What about the rural parts of the country? This has got to be hitting them even harder.
Well, Kathleen, I actually live in what they call the exurbs, so I'm surrounded by farmland and kind of a couple hours north of Detroit, so it's very rural. And I can tell you that the first thing that's happening is they're all talking about giving up their pickup trucks.
Right.
I mean, and we're from Detroit. Can you imagine?
Some right.
They build the pickup trucks, and they're talking about switching to something else, which, of course, is always risky driving, you know, some other vehicle to your work where you're making the pickup trucks, but they just can't afford it. So we're seeing that. We're actually seeing housing prices and actual people moving. We're seeing actual neighbors that are saying, I can't afford to live an hour and a half in the rural areas. So in a way, there's nobody coming in to kind of help them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're making some switches themselves because the jobs aren't necessarily going to be out there like they were in the past. Electricians, construction workers, you know, that whole industry is taking a big beating recently.
Yeah.
The Oakland County government here is planning on moving to a 4-day, 10-hour-a-day work week so that people can drive 20% less.
And that's happening in other parts of the country as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What profound changes here.
I think we're also going to see a big rise for the people that can do this in telecommuting. People working out of their houses, using the high-speed internet connections to do video conferencing, audio conferencing, web meetings, and eliminate a lot of the travel that's really just about getting people in the same room.
Right.
As a matter of fact, Kathleen, one of our other comrades at the Institute, Dominic Crea, recently the local community college told him, look, we don't want to bring the students into our campus. We want you to go online, and he's literally doing an entire science around green technology and renewable technologies all online using video, YouTube, internet technology to make it less of a driving situation for the students.
Well, that's a shame because so much of college is talking with each other in person, right?
That's right. So there's going to be kind of what are the implications of the fact that we don't really get to see each other as much on that one-on-one. And maybe it'll obviously be some kind of hybrid. They can't do it completely that way. Though John is getting his degree in renewable master's from Australia.
Oh, my gosh.
Even my Prius couldn't do that commute.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Please tell me, gentlemen, before we go to phone calls, and we have many, why are we so behind the eight ball on this? Why is it that the Honda Civic and the Toyota Corolla are the cars that are selling now? They've surpassed Detroit. Why is it that we've lived through this before? And we got smart people around the country who can put together some alternatives to oil. Why in the world haven't we done it?
Well, you know, first of all, that there certainly was a change in direction in policy. So, you know, after the 70s, Reagan took office and had a different view of all this. And the first thing he did was take the solar panels off the White House roof and cut the budget of the National Renewable Energy Laboratories, where they were doing the basic scientific research to find the kind of solutions that people are looking for today. And they laid off a third of the staff in a single day there. So clearly we have a policy failure that this was not recognized as a long-term problem. And we, you know, enjoyed the cheap oil while it was there, and we, you know, drove bigger cars and moved further out and really ignored the geological time bomb that we were sitting on.
It's hard to believe we would do that.
Well, Kathleen, think about this. I kind of, when I do the presentation, I put up a chart that shows kind of the miracle of this liquid that took 200 million years to kind of bake into the special property. And if you look at the timeline going back 1,000 years, it looks like this blip of oil, and then it kind of goes away for the next 1,000 years. And it was like you discovered in your basement this huge treasure, inheritance, so to speak, and you were just caught up in the human natural response. Gosh, I've got all, you know, a million extra dollars. Let's spend it versus invest it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a phenomenon where, you know, we're competing as a country, so we have the chance. We could make long-term investments, or do we have to deliver, you know, returns to our corporations that are quarterly based so that we can compete with now emerging markets across the planet? And I think we kind of took our eye off of that, and it turned out we have some scrambling to do, and the runway may be too short to do this without problems.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. There are going to be problems for a while now, significant problems.
And this stands in contrast to Europe, where they instituted tax policy and increased gasoline prices $4, $5, $6 a gallon for the last 20 years, and took that money and built a lot of mass transit systems. Europe's got an excellent rail system for transportation. Europe uses one-half of the oil per capita. Western Europe, developed wealthy nations, one-half of the oil per capita the U.S. does. Japan uses one-third of the oil per capita that the U.S. does. So clearly we could have done much better.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines will be excuse the word, you don't want to hear it today, flooded, I'm sure. So call in early. And I'm particularly interested in hearing from some of you who have made fairly dramatic decisions about your lifestyle as a result of gas going over $4 a gallon. Maybe you live pretty far from where you work. How do you cope with filling up the tank, which is really taking a huge chunk out of people's budget each month? Have you changed the kind of car that you drive? What do you think about the fact that we haven't found an alternative and now we're looking at $4.05, $4.20, who knows how high the price of gas is going to go this summer, and we don't have everything in place to switch to new kinds of technologies as quickly as we should in order to save people a whole lot of heartache. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And our guests are the co-founders of the Institute for Sustainable Energy Education, a grassroots energy think tank and outreach organization made up of concerned scientists and citizens who focus on providing awareness and education as it relates to the science and economics of energy. John Richter, co-founder, Tim Hudson, co-founder, and they will both be speaking at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, the 19th Annual Energy Fair, June 20th through June 22nd in Custer, Wisconsin. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, just out in paperback. The Boston Globe in its review has said this is must reading for every presidential candidate who wants to understand why the nation repeatedly stumbles into one disaster abroad after another. All right, let's go to phone calls. We start with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I have a comment, prediction, and perhaps a partial solution. My comment is I think we have to lay this situation on the doorstep of all of the politicians. Just incredible mismanagement, incredible lack of vision for the country. You know, especially if we compare it with Europe and Japan, as your guests have said, more power to your guests. The fact of the matter is that no matter how you dice it or slice it, it's going to take 10 or 15 years before we can replace petroleum as our principal source of energy for transportation. There's no two ways about it. The question is, how do we survive between today and year 15. Unfortunately, my prediction is that we're going to end up in what I've thought, you know, what I've often thought is the resource wars. We're going to go to war to get control of oil because, you know, 80% of the world's oil is in the Middle East. And, you know, for the next 10 or 15 years, our economy, our jobs, our lifestyle, our way of being is going to depend on decisions that are made today as to our access to that oil. Partial solution, perhaps with larger companies, people who employ, you know, let's say more than 300 people, carpooling, you know, busing people in from hubs where they drive to and then, you know, get on the bus to go to work, may be a partial solution. Thanks.
Thanks so much for the call. Great points. Gentlemen?
Kathleen, one quick comment, and I'm going to let John handle the resource wars because he covers the geopolitics in a very nice way in his presentation. Typically what we've seen is there's many different people that speak about this idea of peak oil that's driven this whole issue. And the politicians, first of all, we know they have to get elected, so nobody wants to be the next Jimmy Carter. We've shown what happens when you tell the truth. For some reason, we as citizens, you know, vote them out of office. So there's this fear that if they really say what they really know, because they know, we've talked to them, John's talked to them, that they're going to simply get fired because we're not ready to hear it. So the politicians have that problem, which is us, the voters. And two, they tend to listen to the economists. And the economists really are behind the ball on this because classic economic theory has trained them that basically supply and demand forces solve these problems through appropriate substitution. But when a planet hits a finite resource like this at the planetary level, some of those supply and demand forces actually don't behave the way the economic theories have predicted, and they have not yet educated the politicians to this new reality. So in a way, there's a couple groups behind the eight ball. The scientists, though, and some of the academic folks, they've been on this for probably since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a matter of who's got the loudest megaphone speaking about it. And John, maybe you can cover about the resource war potential future.
Yeah, and just on that economics piece, this is the first time in the history of mankind we've ever exhausted a non-renewable resource. And so there is no historical precedent to go back and look at, and I think we're going to have some relearning to do there. As far as the resource wars, I mean, I think we're already there. The U.S. has got 150,000 troops in the Persian Gulf, and if there wasn't any oil there, and the Persian Gulf holds 75%, actually two-thirds of the world's oil is in the Persian Gulf, 75% is in OPEC. If the oil wasn't there, I don't think our troops would be there either.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's been a tremendous amount of saber-rattling about Iran, which is probably the one other nation that has oil resources that haven't been fully developed into production yet.
And what about carpooling, John?
Oh, I think we're going to see a lot of carpooling. I think we're going to see Internet services set up to help facilitate carpooling. We have around the Detroit area park and rides that were set up specifically to help facilitate that, where they just put a parking lot next to a major freeway interchange. And those are now filling because people are going back to that. It's something you can do very quickly within, as the Colin was saying, you know, the 10 or 15-year period, which I actually think is going to be a little longer than that.
Do you really?
I'm afraid so. We've got 210 million cars out on the road there. We actually have more licensed vehicles in the United States than we have licensed drivers. And they have a median life expectancy of 17 years. So somehow we've got to work through that installed base, and we're still building more gas guzzlers.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, so much for your call. Frank is next from Madison. Good morning, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Fine guests, fine topic as usual. If I'm sorry to make this a personal narrative, but I in the past used to take the Lakeshore Limited from Boston to Chicago, and more recently I've been going from Boston to Chicago, Madison, in a Smart 4.2 CDI. That's a diesel. And I get low mileage, which is 72 miles to the gallon. And I have a question for your guests, which is, why the low utilization of diesel vehicles in the United States when they offer high mileage, 30% more in terms of energy efficiency than comparable gas vehicles? And then second, to what extent is peak oil truly real? Our friends at The Economist, not that it isn't understood that that's the true dynamic, but our friends at The Economist in the current issue say that true reserves are probably twice those that are officially recognized. So thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Hey, Kathleen, let me, Frank, that was a great question. I'll cover quickly the peak oil reality, and John's got some comments on the diesel. Peak oil, you're right. There's a lot of debate. You know, how much is left? Is it a trillion? Is it 2 trillion? We have a Pulitzer Prize winner, Mr. Yergin, who wrote the bestseller book called The Prize and is part of the Cambridge Energy Research Institute, gets paid a lot of money and is out there actually purporting that peak oil is a myth. This is not true. We're not going to peak. We're going to plateau. So we basically, as the institute, we study the people who have studied the problem. So we're not the original researchers. We study the people to try to figure out, as citizens, how do we know if this is really true? What if this is just Y2K all over again, and we're just getting ourselves all emotional over nothing? And we look at the data, and in our presentations, what we try to do is say, if you look at the data and you do the calculations and you frame the issue, you will see that even if you take the most conservative, hopeful view and you frame it, this is a problem in our lifetime and certainly in our children's lifetime, and that the transition looks like it's going to be insufficient because we did lose that 30 years of runway. So without getting into all the numbers, but if you come to the workshop, you will leave knowing some serious numbers. You will see exactly what kind of production is occurring, which may suggest we're at peak already for the last 3 years. The world cannot get out of the ground anything more than it's done for 3 straight years. It has gone flatline. So there's strong indications, but nobody knows for sure till about 5 years after if we've peaked. What counts is, did the price go up? Is it going up dramatically? That's what counts probably more than whether we peaked. it could happen in advance. And I think peak is not the issue. Price is the issue. And we're seeing that. So let's start dealing with the fact that we've got a price problem that's at 4, predicted to go to 12, by the way, by Dr. Hirsch last week on CNBC. So this has got much more dramatic and dire predictions from very conservative government Republican side people, and not just what they call the doomsday Chicken Littles out there, yelling that that we're running out of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, Kathleen, one last point before
sure.
John takes it.
Yeah.
We're not running out of oil. We're running out of cheap oil. We still have trillions of barrels, and it's going to be how expensive will that oil be, even if you have a lot of it.
Yeah.
So, John, on diesel?
Yeah, and Frank, congratulations on your Smart for Two. That's a great move, and I hope a lot of people follow in your footsteps. In Europe, where they have priced petrol very high for decades, half of all cars being sold are diesels, precisely for the reason Frank states that the fuel economy, the actual energy and engine efficiency due to the higher compression ratio is about 30% higher, and there's more BTUs per gallon of diesel fuel as well. So the mileage on a diesel is anything from 30 to 60% better than a gasoline-powered car. Now, what's held that up here in the U.S. have been environmental regulations regarding the particulate emissions of diesel, and these have been addressed just recently by the EPA, which is requiring the refiners to dramatically reduce the sulfur content in our diesel fuel so that the manufacturers can add particulate traps onto the diesel engines and remove those very nasty cancer-causing or emphysema-causing particulates. So that we can put a lot more diesels on the road. And I think we're going to see a dramatic move toward diesels in the U.S. across the next 5 years here.
Thanks, Frank, for your always great questions and comments. Sharon from Duluth. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. The first caller really addressed a lot of what I was going to say, but now that we're on diesel, is there any problem with diesel in the real cold weather like we get up in Minnesota and Wisconsin and so forth? I have more, but... This is the first time that I have been just totally angry, just livid, in thinking about our politicians, as the first caller said, and the idea that they are so afraid to say what they know, and they must know because the average citizen, many of us who have kept track of anything and listened to public radio for one thing, have known for quite some time that this is not going well. Their interest in getting reelected seems to be more important to them than their interest in the well-being of the country. And this is my take on it recently, and I've become very angry about it. I was sorry to hear you say, like the first caller, I was trying to look at a positive way of looking at it, and I thought, okay, it may take us 10 years. I'm getting older, and I may not be around when things get better, but it's not going to last forever, and some of the kids I know and so forth will not have to go through this. Well, I'm still hoping for 10 years, but that's probably too hopeful given what I've said about our politicians. The one other thing that discourages me is I was sitting with a bunch of friends who, to me, seem to be fairly politically savvy and somewhat green-minded and so forth, and they were still talking about taking their leisurely drives 40, 50 miles into the country to check out some little restaurant and so forth. And... I think I need to talk with them. I was just sitting there listening and kind of amazed and didn't know how to respond. That's about all.
Thank you.
A lot of what I said was said. Thanks so much for this program.
Thanks so much, Sharon, for the call. John, Tim.
Kathleen, Sharon, we're getting a lot of that reaction now, which is particularly people that had thought of this issue and just can't figure out why more people have not kind of joined in so that we could make a more massive shift earlier so we don't have to have what looks like, you know, again, some problematic transitional era. We're going to end it okay, but there could be problematic transitional period for 10 to 30 or 40 years, and that's right in the middle of, you know, what many people had anticipated to be a different type of future retirement. But when she mentions, do the politicians know? George Bush knows. You know, not only what he said, we're addicted to oil, but his advisors are some of the leading people in this movement. The guy that wrote the book, Twilight in the Desert, that really points out when Saudi Arabia peaks, the world peaks, and we think they're peaking, Matt Simmons is a Bush advisor. These politicians know, we've had politicians come to us and say, you know, I can't still bring this up. And I'm talking about within the last year. They still feel hesitant to bring this up. So what we're trying to do is arm them. And they, so at least we know they know and that there's another issue preventing them. And I think we have to create a safe space to tell the truth. So in a way, this just the reality of kind of the doom message has to be said. And maybe if you get the reality of it and we all begin to accept that our politicians can tell the truth, then maybe we can have a dialogue. Because it, the doom message just means it's reality, but it doesn't mean that there's not many things we could do versus denial. And, you know, one of the theories is this is like the grieving process. We're simply unwilling to face this thing, so we're going to go through the stages of coping with grief by denying it, by going to isolation, by being depressed about it, instead of facing it and accepting it, much like you would with the death process that... Mm-hmm. And, John, there was any comment about diesels again?
Well, first of all, Sharon, congratulations. You've moved from denial to anger. So you're now in the phase of the
grieving. We got fun.
process. And as people start talking about these miracle new technologies or these vast oil finds that are just waiting around the corner, that's called bargaining. And we're going to have a lot of that, too. The Bush administration has more oil savvy than any administration in history, and clearly they know what's going on. And I think they really had a gambit that we could control the last major oil production out of the Persian Gulf and thereby assure us another decade of plenty. And I think that's proved to not work out so well. But in addition, it was just a very short-sighted policy, and I almost feel like the politicians are like that great line from the movie, you can't handle the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the president, as he was going to Europe, his response to this is, well, we need to look at our own sources. And he brings up this topic of the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge again, which clearly is not politically popular and not popular among the American people. I mean, where is he going with this? That's not going to happen.
Well, this is something we get that gets brought up at every conference because – we're seeing the national debate will come around once a year to focus on that area. So what we do is we say, okay, let's again be thinking citizens because we're not sure who's right and how it's going to all happen. So as data comes in and discussions about, you know, the Arctic Refuge, how do we think about it and should we agree or disagree with going after that oil? Well, we simply show one chart that pretty much puts this whole thing to shame, which is if we took and drilled everything that we think we could get out of there, we might get something like 3 billion barrels. Well, the U.S. uses almost 8 billion a year. So we're talking less than a six-month supply.
Oh,
what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's got the numbers. They don't have what we call energy numeracy to just simply say, in context, don't spend a lot of time talking about it. I bet you we're going to drill it because people aren't going to realize, you know, we got to get something and we're going to panic and we're going to end up drilling it. But then it'll be later realized for naught.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's a six-month supply? It'll take 15 years to get that six-month supply, but it's not material. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's not a relevant part of the conversation.
Yeah. Here's an interesting email. This is a poignant topic for me today. I bike to work for the first time since junior high. I live in Milwaukee. I work in Brookfield, which is, you know, about 15 miles. A little less than that, probably, and have committed to biking 30 miles a day to cut costs in gas and reduce my footprint. It will literally save hundreds of dollars a month. I'm 24 years old, and the east side of Milwaukee is where I want to live, but my job is in the suburbs. I figure my decision to live far from work should be balanced with a financial and environmentally responsible decision. What's the cost? I sacrifice an hour of sleep.
Well, I think there's another benefit there that he's overlooked, which is the health benefit.
Yeah, he's going to be fit, right?
That hour of biking is phenomenal. And I you know, there's a lot of proposals for biking at these conferences and stuff, and there's a variety of issues there. One is that our population is aging, and so some folks don't have the health to be able to do that, although maybe if they were, it would help. We've got cold climates here in Michigan and Wisconsin, right? So
mm-hmm.
biking in the winter is certainly more difficult. But I actually tried that. I had a 5-mile commute with a bike path, and I decided I was going to bike to work. And after my second near-death incident in 2 days, because the cars just don't see you.
Mm.
So I had a bike path, but there were driveways in and out of that bike path, and nobody's looking.
Let's go to more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Norb from Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Norb.
Hey, thanks for letting a neighbor speak. But I just think the story is not the price of gasoline. The story is that the Saudis are satisfied with $80 a barrel. The rest of the price is done primarily by the three banks in New York that are hedging this thing, and the one-fourth of the cost of our oil, of our gasoline, is because of the hedge fund operators. And the federal government passed a law in the year 2000 that allows these guys to operate in dark rooms across the country that cannot be controlled by the federal government. Phil Graham was the senator who was responsible for putting a rider on a bill in year 2000, and Soros testified at a congressional hearing about 2 weeks ago, and this story cannot get out. And it happens to be the three banks that lost a great deal of money in the housing market, and now they're trying to make it back with their hedge fund operation. And I'd just like to have you comment about that and whether you even know about this story.
Okay.
Yeah, certainly. So the story's gotten out enough that at least I've heard of it. There was a change in the law in 2000 regarding the futures exchanges for oil. There are certainly a lot of speculators that have moved into this market, and speculators can drive the price up, at least in the short term. But here's what speculators can't do, and in fact, it's quite the opposite. Speculators can't restrict the amount of oil that comes out of the ground. And one of the economic functions of speculators is to drive up the price if they think there's going to be a supply shortage, such that that price signal has more people going out there and, you know, developing more resources. And that hasn't happened. So global oil extraction rates in 2006 was slightly less than 2005, and 2007 was less yet, and it's continuing to drop, despite the fact that the price has quintupled. So that tells me that we've got a geological problem, and yes, there are probably some speculators who are kind of accelerating that price increase, but the problem is really much more fundamental.
Thank you, Norb, so much for calling from Oak Park, Illinois. Fine community. Carl is next from Shawano. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Kathleen. I can't believe there hasn't been more recognition on the article that was in the Popular Mechanics magazine, the January issue, page 71. They currently have a diesel-powered car in Europe called Apollo, Blue Mount Apollo, that gets, according to the article, 74.3 miles a gallon. And a little quote from the article says, while hybrids might be the greener champions, cleaner diesels can be just as friendly to the environment, possibly friendlier. I don't know why there hasn't been more discussion about this vehicle coming to the United States. This would seem to me to solve a large part of our transportation problem. If you get a vehicle that goes 74 miles to the gallon, I never heard. I don't know why people haven't talked about this more.
Tim, John,
yeah. So there is a tremendous opportunity for more fuel efficient vehicles, both through electric hybrids and through diesels, and through the combination of the two. Toyota created a concept car that was called the ES3 that was based on the Yaris, and it was a combination diesel-electric hybrid, and it got 105 miles to the gallon. So clearly there's an enormous amount we can do if we're willing to move to diesels, move to hybrids, pay a little bit more for a smaller vehicle to get dramatically better fuel economy.
Mm-hmm.
Until very recently, the U.S. public was not willing to do that. The number one selling car for most of the months of the last three decades was the Ford F-150 pickup.
And wow.
That was true even into the fourth quarter of 2007.
Oh, my gosh.
So part of our mission here was to get the message out so that people knew this was going to happen so they could make wise choices. And it's just hard to do that in the face of gasoline was cheap.
Gasoline was cheap, and you would buy a pickup because why?
Well, I never did, so
I know.
I might be the wrong person to ask.
I'm wondering if it was marketed as safer, or you could be a tough guy or gal driving it, or what it was.
Well, there was a combination of factors. So clearly some people have a need for a pickup truck in their business, right? And, I've got no issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I see an awful lot of them in my parking lots around the office buildings, right? And part of it is image. Clearly the advertising has played to that image of you're a rough and tumble guy if you drive a pickup truck. The Detroit Auto Show has just been a cornucopia of testosterone. I mean, it's all about minds bigger. And there's also the safety factor. We sort of have an arms race on our highways of whoever's in the biggest car is safer to the detriment of the safety of everyone else.
Right. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return. Our number is 800-486-8655 with gasoline prices very, very high and affecting people's ability to get to work, affecting their ability to buy food, actually, and to manage their pocketbooks. We're talking with guests from the Institute for Sustainable Energy. John Richter is with us and Tim Hudson. They are the co-founders, and they will present at you're keenly interested in this topic, so we should remind you that the Midwest Renewable Energy Association hosting their 19th annual energy fair June 20th through June 22nd in Custer, Wisconsin. 20,000 fair attendees each year, probably more this year because we're going through so much. If you'd like more information about the fair, they do have a website, which is themrea.org, www.the-mrea.org. We'll also give you a phone number toward the end of this hour. More phone calls in a moment. If you'd like to send an email, we can do that too. That is talk@wpr.org. Or 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee. Thanks, Carl, for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today, the author of Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Back to phone calls for our guests, and we go next to Greg from Watertown. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Kathleen. Wonderful show as usual. I'm really concerned about energy prices, too, but I think the reason why we're suffering these high energy prices right now is because of our mechanistic view of thinking. We reduce things to kind of the meanest level of things. And oftentimes that's the economic element of the equation. Well, I'd like to put forward that it's more than simply economics. We have environmental constraints. That's what peak oil is all about. And when we reduce things to simple economic terms, it does not take into account social aspects. It does not take into account physical constraints. And I think there's a program out there that is going to offer us some solutions to the problem, not just temporary fixes, not just treating the symptom, but actual solutions to the problem. And it's called the Natural Step, and it's going to be part of the feature of the MREA Energy Fair this year. And the Natural Step is a systems thinking perspective for managing complex systems, and it helps us evaluate both social, environmental, and economic aspects of any issue you want to bring up. And it's a very holistic methodology, and it is a complete methodology for analyzing systems. And I guess I'd like to hear your guests' comments on this and what they think about it.
Okay.
Greg, thank you. That I think I was exposed to the Natural Step at last week's conference in Grand Rapids, and I do think that's going to provide a way to expand the conversation so that you can get all the edges of the value systems and discussion points, because you're right, this is not going to be solved on an economic level alone, and part of what we try to do, we're kind of called the Energy Mythbusters, is to kind of burst exactly what Craig's talking about, this very economic assumption that is part of the peak oil conversation. We do a little thing called, you know, the peak oil conversation has three sides. It's not just the energy on one side or the economics on the other side, but that skinny side of a coin is the environment. And everyone talks about the different pieces from a different value system, and typically we leave out, you know, one of the sides of the coin, and we're finding out there's actually multiple sides to that coin. If you want, if some of the people listening to this want to really dig into that kind of bigger thinking approach, even the original authors that talked about peak oil, like Richard Heinberg in his book The Party's Over, he's come up with a follow-on book or two called Power Down, and another one called Peak Everything, which really begins to stop talking about the resources and all this graphic data stuff that John and I spend a lot of time on, but really gets into the area I think Greg's trying to get us to think about, the stuff that we probably don't know, we don't know, our blind spot is particularly in the U.S., and myself included, on how we even want to live our lives, and we even want to construct the rules for our civilization.
Right.
So
right.
Greg is dead on. We're probably not going to get people to pay attention to that part, where they're scrambling to get to work, and rationing tickets are coming out for gas. So I'm not sure how much we're going to be able to get that conversation to be relevant when there's more urgent panic. I don't mean just, we're going to have panic in the streets, but just people are not thinking of the environment. They're not going to think about these holistic solutions because they need to feed their kids. And what worries us is kind of that attitude taking over for what I think is the longer-term Greg attitude of the natural step.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Pat from Appleton, who's done something interesting. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I live 70 miles from where I work, and so it's a very long commute. And what I did was I figured out some number crunching on a different way to approach my job, and then I went to my boss and offered to take a cut in pay and work every other week. And for my brain, this is the most enthusiastic I've ever been about going to work, and it's wonderful having every other week off. So that's it. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of people having all kinds of creative approaches to solving this that in many cases are unique to their situation. That she could work that out is fabulous.
Here's an email. I've been hearing about the fishermen and the truckers striking in Western Europe in protest of the diesel costs skyrocketing. Do you foresee that happening in the U.S. anytime soon? I think this would wake up some of the politicians when truckers stop traffic in some of the major cities.
I think that's likely. We saw some of that in the 70s. There were certainly some truckers' protests then. There have been quite a few articles and things about the hardship that particularly the small independent truckers are suffering from these diesel prices. Diesel is even higher than gasoline. And I think their pain is going to continue and increase, and therefore we're probably going to see some truckers' protests, yes.
We go next to Gary from Ashland. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm driving in to work every day on an all-electric vehicle. It's a 99 Ford Ranger truck. And I have a 15-mile one-way commute, and I get about 45 miles effective range on a charge, and I just did the calculations. It cost me less than 3 cents a mile.
Oh, my gosh.
At time of use, I have it set up for that, and when I get my solar array and my wind generator up on my five-acre homestead, I will have free energy to drive with.
Wow. Now, how did you get the car? It wasn't sold on the market that way.
It was eBay.
It was eBay.
No, it was a Ford production truck made for the zero emissions law in California. And it was at L.A. International Airport, so it's screaming yellow. It has vanity plates that say e-trucks, and I'm driving it between Washburn and Ashland every day. So if you're up here, you may see it.
So you got to go to eBay to get one of these, John and Tim.
Yeah, Gary, congratulations, by the way. It's leaders and people that are thinking advanced like you that make things happen. One of the funniest things happened at the conference that I think you're going to get hit with, because this conversation, as you can see, it's going to get angry on all sides. And they started referring to people like Gary as, that's not an EV car. That's a coal car. That's a car that's being fueled by electric power plants that are burning coal, and coal is about to peak.
Right.
So there's no solution there. Where's the sun or the wind driving that car? So Gary, since you're a leader, not only drive the electric car, but start figuring a way to now plug it into something that's not on the end full of coal. And John has a thought.
Yeah, I mean, I really think we're going to see a tremendous electrification of our transportation system. And a big part of that's going to be EVs, and then part of that's going to be electric mass transit, right? Subways and rail and trolley cars. And that is going to create a schism kind of in the debate here, because you've got the folks who are really trying to just address, how do I do transportation without oil, in which case electric vehicles are the obvious choice. you've got other folks who are very concerned about global warming. And as long as we're making half of the U.S.'s electricity from coal, which produces more CO2 than other ways, you've got a tremendous environmental impact. That if we all switch to EVs, those coal plants are going to basically run at capacity all night to charge our cars, and that's going to put a lot more CO2 in the air, which is why we need to couple that movement to electric vehicles with a mass implementation of wind farms, as well as photovoltaic and solar concentrating power systems.
Mm. And Kathleen, Gary needs to put some pressure wherever he's getting his electricity from to say, look, mm-hmm. give me the wind, because right now I can tell you the nuclear industry is not sitting still. And don't forget, former members of Greenpeace are actually promoting nuclear because it is better for global warming, mm-hmm. but it's got other problems.
Right.
As a potential solution, we're talking about, we've heard things last week that there would be 10,000 new nuclear power plants to fill this 10 to 30 to 40 year gap.
And on that note, we got to end, gentlemen. We are totally out of time. Thank you. You were terrific. Have fun at the fair. Thank you. Our guests, John Richter and Tim Hudson from the Institute for Sustainable Energy Education. Just a reminder, the fair is taking place June 20th through June 22nd, 715-592-6595. For more information, thanks to John Anderson, our intern who produced this show, his first show, John Treader, for on-air production. We'll be back following the news.